Winston S. Churchill, The Second World War, Volume 4, The Hinge of Fate. Victory was never in doubt in my grandfather's mind once the United States had entered the war and the Grand Alliance had been formed. He was equally sure that in the immediate future, a long line of disasters would befall the Alliance before it could gather its strength and mobilize its resources to the full. Those disasters came swiftly. Singapore, Tobruk, and the Philippines all fell to the enemy. At sea, there was both the ever-increasing loss of shipping to the U-boat menace and the humiliation of daylight passage through the channel of the German heavy cruisers Gneisenau and Scharnhorst. Such setbacks caused political difficulties at home for the national government. A motion of no confidence and a motion of censure were respectively debated in the House of Commons after the fall of Singapore and the fall of Tobruk. They were overwhelmingly defeated, but were nevertheless worrying, and changes were made in the composition of the government as a result. Successes were few and far between, but come they did. In March, British commandos made a daring raid on the French port of Saint-Nazaire and destroyed docking and repair facilities that could have been of vital use to German warships. In the Battle of the Coral Sea, American forces stalled further Japanese advances and demonstrated the importance of air power in the naval war in the Pacific. Shortly thereafter, American forces inflicted a major defeat on the Japanese in the Battle of Midway, when they sunk four Japanese aircraft carriers. The Japanese had got as far as they were ever to get in the Pacific. Meanwhile, in the Desert War, after the humiliation of Tobruk, General Auchinleck managed to hold Rommel and the Afrika Korps at Alamein. Shortly after, there were major changes effected by my grandfather to the Middle East Command, with General Alexander replacing Auchinleck and Montgomery taking over command of the 8th Army. From then on, our fortunes went from strength to strength. Montgomery's famous victory in the Battle of El Alamein broke the enemy's power in the Desert War. Cairo was safe, and it was only a matter of time before final victory could be achieved in that theater. Alamein was one of the hinges upon which the whole war pivoted. In addition to the actual battles in the field, there were also battles to be fought in the strategic planning rooms of the Allies. During 1942, the problem of a second front became a major issue, not just because of different views between British and American planners, but also because of the situation of the Soviets. The Soviets took the main brunt of the German army's destructive power in 1941 and 1942. They suffered massive losses, but were not defeated. The Soviet army was still in the field and fighting tenaciously. Stalin, however, called for more help to take the pressure away from the Eastern Front. The best way to do that was to have a second front in the West. My grandfather had to tell him at their first meeting that the opening of a second front through a cross-channel assault would be unwise and impossible in 1942. This caused considerable acrimony during their conference in Moscow, but in the end Stalin accepted that the best way for Britain and America to strike at the enemy was from the air and through the opening of a second front in French North Africa. That campaign was only decided upon after much argument among British and American planners. There was fear that the United States might concentrate on the war against Japan if it did not engage with German forces in 1942. But Roosevelt was determined to stick with the priority of defeating Germany first. So when consensus arose that a 1942 attack against occupied France would be unwise, the president came down in favor of my grandfather's idea of landings in French North Africa. By the early summer of 1943, things were moving inexorably in favor of the Grand Alliance. The turning point on the Eastern Front came early in the year, with the defeat of General Paulus's army at Kursk. The landings in French North Africa were successful. By mid-May, Africa was free from all enemy forces. In the Pacific, meanwhile, the tide was turning against the Japanese. In the Mediterranean, Anglo-American forces were poised for the invasion of Italy. My grandfather's conviction that the Allies would win, despite the terrible setbacks of late 41 and early 42, was being borne out by events.
I was expected to make a full statement to Parliament about my mission to Washington and all that had happened in the 5 weeks I had been away. Two facts stood out in my mind. The first was that the Grand Alliance was bound to win the war in the long run. The second was that a vast, measureless army of disasters approached us in the onslaught of Japan. Everyone could see with intense relief that our life as a nation and empire was no longer at stake. On the other hand, the fact that the sense of mortal danger was largely removed set every critic, friendly or malevolent, free to point out the many errors which had been made. On my return from Washington, I was confronted by criticism of the national government's direction of the war. On January the 21st, Rommel again took the initiative in the Desert War, advancing swiftly and rolling back our army 300 miles. Auchinleck's gains of the previous months were thus negated, and our position did not look promising. But the main concern was our pitifully weak position in the Far East, and fear of further pending disaster at the hands of the Japanese. These matters led to demands for a vote of confidence in the House of Commons. On January the 27th, the debate began, and I laid our case before the House. I could see they were in a querulous temper, because when I had asked as soon as I got home that my forthcoming statement might be electrically recorded so that it could be used for broadcasting to the Empire and the United States, objection was taken on various grounds which had no relation to the needs of the hour. I therefore withdrew my request, although it would not have been denied in any other parliament in the world. It was in such an atmosphere that I rose to speak. I gave them some account of the desert battle, but the House did not, of course, appreciate the significance of Rommel's successful counterstroke, for they could be given no inkling of the larger plans that would be opened by a swift British conquest of Tripolitania. The loss of Benghazi and Agadabia, which had already become public, seemed to be a part of the sudden ebbs and flows of desert warfare. Moreover, I had at the time no precise information as to what had happened and why. I presently came to the larger issue of our nakedness in the Far East. The decision was taken to make our contribution to Russia, to try to beat Rommel, and to form a stronger front from the Levant to the Caspian. It followed from that decision that it was in our power only to make a moderate and partial provision in the Far East against the hypothetical danger of a Japanese onslaught. 60,000 men, indeed, were concentrated at Singapore, but priority in modern aircraft, in tanks, and in anti-aircraft and anti-tank artillery was accorded to the Nile Valley. I thought it well to end by putting things at their worst and making no promises while not excluding hope. The debate then ran on for 3 days, but the tone to me was unexpectedly friendly. There was no doubt what the House would do. My colleagues in the War Cabinet, headed by Mr. Attlee, sustained the government case with vigour and even fierceness. I had to wind up on the 29th. At this time I feared that there would be no division. I tried by taunts to urge our critics into the lobby against us, without at the same time offending the now thoroughly reconciled Assembly. But nothing that I dared say could spur any of the disaffected figures in the Conservative, Labour and Liberal parties into voting. Luckily, when the division was called, the vote of confidence was challenged by the Independent Labour Party, who numbered 3. 2 were required as tellers, and the result was 464-1. I was grateful to James Maxton, the leader of the minority, for bringing the matter to a head. Such a fuss had been made by the press that telegrams of relief and congratulation flowed in from all over the Allied world. The warmest were from my American friends at the White House. I had sent congratulations to the President on his 60th birthday. "It is fun," he cabled, "to be in the same decade with you." The naggers in the press were not, however, without resource. They spun round with the alacrity of squirrels. How unnecessary it had been to ask for a vote of confidence. Who had ever dreamed of challenging the national government? These shrill voices, as I called them, were but the unknowing heralds of approaching catastrophe. The Japanese threat to Singapore was uppermost in our minds. It soon became clear that General Wavell, now supreme Allied commander of these eastern regions, had already doubts of our ability to maintain a prolonged defense of Singapore. I had counted much upon the island and fortress standing a siege, requiring heavy artillery to be landed, transported, and mounted by the Japanese. Before I left Washington, I still contemplated a resistance of at least 2 months. I watched with misgivings, but without effective intervention, the consumption of our forces in their retreat through the Malay Peninsula. On the other hand, there was the gain of precious time. But on January the 16th, Wavell telegraphed, "Until quite recently, all plans were based on repulsing seaborne attacks on Singapore Island and holding land attack in Johor or further north. And little or nothing was done to construct defenses on north side of island to prevent crossing Johor Straits, though arrangements had been made to blow up the causeway. The fortress cannon of heaviest nature have all round traverse, but their flat trajectory makes them unsuitable for counter battery work. Could certainly not guarantee to dominate enemy siege batteries with them." It was with feelings of painful surprise that I read this message on the morning of the 19th. So there were no permanent fortifications covering the landward side of the naval base and of the city. Moreover, even more astounding, no measures worth speaking of had been taken by any of the commanders since the war began, and more especially since the Japanese had established themselves in Indochina to construct field defenses. They had not even mentioned the fact that they did not exist. My immediate reaction was to repair the neglect so far as time allowed. But when I awoke on the morning of the 21st, the following most pessimistic telegram from General Wavell lay at the top of my box. It read, "Officer, whom I had sent to Singapore for plans of defense of island, has now returned. Schemes are now being prepared for defense of northern part of island. Number of troops required to hold island effectively probably are as great as or greater than number required to defense Johor. I have ordered Percival, the commander-in-chief, to fight out the battle in Johor, but to work out plans to prolong resistance on island as long as possible, should he lose Johor battle. I must warn you, however, that I doubt whether island can be held for long once Johor is lost." I pondered over this message for a long time, and then prepared the following minute to the chiefs of staff, and gave it to General Ismay in time for their meeting on the 21st of January. "We have already committed exactly the error which I feared. Forces which might have made a solid front in Johor, or at any rate along the Singapore waterfront, have been broken up piecemeal. No defensive line has been constructed on the landward side. No defense has been made by the Navy to the enemy's turning movements on the west coast of the peninsula. General Wavell has expressed the opinion that it will take more troops to defense Singapore Island than to win the battle in Johor. The battle in Johor is almost certainly lost. His message gives little hope for prolonged defense. It appears to me that this question should be squarely faced now and put bluntly to General Wavell. What is the value of Singapore to the enemy above the many harbors in the Southwest Pacific if all naval and military demolitions are thoroughly carried out? On the other hand, the loss of Burma would be very grievous. It would cut us off from the Chinese, whose troops have been the most successful of those yet engaged against the Japanese. We may, by muddling things and hesitating to take an ugly decision, lose both Singapore and the Burma Road. Obviously, the decision depends upon how long the defense of Singapore Island can be maintained. If it is only for a few weeks, it is certainly not worth losing all our reinforcements and aircraft."